The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Global Development Podcast. This month it's a review of the year, looking back on 2011 and how things have gone in the development world, also asking what are likely to be the big challenges for 2012. I'm John Vidal, Environment Editor of The Guardian, and with me in the studio is Dina Makram Ebaid, an Egyptian PhD student at the London School of Economics, and Jonathan Glennie, who's a research fellow at the Overseas Development Institute and a very regular blogger on our Global Development website. Joining me on the line from Delhi is Jayati Ghosh, Professor of Economics at Jawaharlal Nehru University, and in Washington is Charles Kenny, an economist and the author of the book Getting Better, which argues that global development is working and aid to development countries is making a difference. Welcome to you all. Right, it's been a tumultuous year, good and bad, but despite the global economic crisis and some extreme climatic events, some regions such as Africa and South America appear to be growing strongly. Charles Kenny, you've written a book called Getting Better. Why do you say development is working?
Well, in the book, I say that development is working because pretty much everything apart from income is getting better everywhere. I'd actually change the story now and say everything is getting better, pretty much. So we've got 28 fewer low-income countries than we had at the start of the decade. That only leaves 35. This year, Zambia and Ghana graduated middle-income country status. If you look at indicators of health over the last decade, the annual toll from child mortality has dropped by 2 million kids just over the course of a decade. So that's, you know, good news for them. Life expectancy is going up almost everywhere. If you look at education, more and more kids are in school than ever before. Pretty much choose your measure, and things are getting better worldwide.
Jonathan, you spent a lot of time in Latin America, and you've talked about a reduction in inequality. Are things really getting better there as well?
I think Charles's assessment is quite convincing when you look at the overall historical picture. You know, in the 80s, Africa was getting worse. Latin America was pretty stagnant. The 90s, things were fairly bad as well. The last 10 years have seen some quite important improvements, not just in income, as Charles says, but in overall kind of the MDG-style development improvements. And, you know, and Charles also looks at especially at improvements in technology and those kind of things that mean that even with less money, people are better off. So I think that broad picture is a good news picture in some ways, and one that actually we have to learn to say a lot more about, because we're quite used to saying how bad things are. Relatively speaking, you know, people are still incredibly poor compared with the very rich. So it's not like things are good. Things are better, and that's an important thing. But nevertheless, there are clouds on the horizon, and they're to do with resource conflict and inequality, which, yes, it has got slightly better in Latin America, but from a very low base.
Jayati, what's the situation in India? Because I was speaking to your environment minister, Jayanti Natarajan, the other day in the climate talks in Durban, and she was telling me that there are still 128 million people there earning under a dollar a day. And per capita GDP is still only $4,000 a year. Are things getting better there as well?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, glass half empty, glass half full is always the issue. But definitely it is the case that we still have an extraordinary amount of poverty. I think the 128 million is an underestimate, actually. It's around 30% of our population, which is more like 300 million. And we really still have a situation where, while there are a clear group of middle class, let's say about 200 million, who are definitely experiencing much better conditions, there is a very, very large population, the majority, where we don't see the same improvement.
But 2011 was a particularly good year or bad year? I mean, how would you rank it, if you like, in the improvement line?
I think 2011 had one very major problem, and that was high food prices globally. And these filtered into very high food prices in India as well. And this is a country where we already have very terrible nutrition indicators for at least half of our population. So this would have actually made things worse in terms of just the nutrition indicators.
Okay, now Dina, it's been an incredible, extraordinary year in 2011 for the Arab world. Are things getting better there, or has actually development been put on hold by all the other events which have taken place?
Well, I think things are better because people have taken control in changing them. And that in itself is the most important thing. As an overall picture, I don't think things have changed much. We're still having the neoliberal project continuing and the same economic and social structures. But I think in measuring how things are getting better, you can't just look at the indicators, because who decides on which indicators are more important? And I think the very idea that people take over the what we even call economic democracy back in Egypt is the most important one, because then they would decide if really the improvement in the number of students who've enrolled in schools was that the most important thing or not. So in a sense, the most important thing to say is that people are taking control, but they're also being harshly repressed.
Which presumably have been some of the underlying reasons why we've had these tumultuous events anyway.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in a sense, the common theme that's all over the Arab world is that the revolutions continue. And they're still ongoing, because as of yet we've changed the main figures, but not the structure really.
Okay, well, Dina, we'll come back to the Arab Spring later on, but we've mentioned disease control and healthcare as something that's definitely improved. But so let's just listen to the Guardian's health editor, Sarah Bosley, with her view of the most important developments in the health area in 2011.
For me, the biggest issues on the health side in development in 2011. Were vaccinations and a couple of very big studies that showed that HIV was actually preventable by using the drugs that people are being treated with at present. Most people will probably say that the vaccinations were the most important thing. As far as I'm concerned, a huge amount of money has been pledged to vaccinations. We've yet to see how that's going to develop and whether that they really will be the value for money that people think. And on the HIV front, what's very interesting there is that these studies do show that if people are given the drugs, that they're less likely to transmit the infection to other people. I think the biggest issue for 2012 is going to be money. That's because of the economic recession. We're seeing really serious signs of a drop-off in funding, but there are some very worrying things happening, and I think particularly the inability of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB and malaria to offer a funding round for next year. This is quite a serious thing.
Okay, so Sarah thinks that at least the vaccination record is better. Jayati, how well is disease control going in India now?
It's a very uneven thing. You have to remember that India is a subcontinent that is more complicated and certainly larger than Europe. And so there are different regions performing at different rates. So some parts like Tamil Nadu and West Bengal and Maharashtra have done very well in terms of vaccination and a number of other indicators like infant mortality and maternal mortality. There are other parts of the country where things have stagnated. And in fact, even some relatively high growing states where things have not got better at all.
Does this depend more on the states or on the federal government?
It's really a combination. One major problem is that the central government, the federal government, hasn't really seen health spending as a major priority. It has not created the overall economic or social conditions that would enable the states, all of them, to spend more and spend successfully in this area.
Charles in Washington, you say disease control is one of the big successes. Why do you think this is happening?
I do think there's a huge role for vaccines. I mean, just take measles. That back in the early 80s, there were about 4.5 million cases of measles worldwide a year, and now we're somewhere around 400,000 cases a year. So less than a tenth the level we were 30 years ago. And I think that is largely to do with vaccines. And you can see similar rates of progress in places like pertussis and polio and diphtheria. But I do take the point about money completely. I think the Global Fund announcement is a very sad one. I think it's particularly sad because we've actually developed some new ways of using money very effectively to reduce health risks, especially to kids in the developing world. I mean, a really exciting advance this year was the rollout of a new vaccine against pneumococcal diseases like pneumonia and sepsis. We are seeing money dry up in these areas. There was better news for Gavi this year than there was for the Global Fund, but still, there isn't enough money going I think to these areas, and it would be great to see more.
Nevertheless, it does seem sometimes that it's easier to deal with the health problems than to deal with some of the poverty or the ingrained problems. Is that the case, Charles?
I'd accept that. I think we've over the last 30 years, we've seen really sort of dramatic improvements in health, although there is still a long way to go. We've seen really dramatic improvements in health. The news is now more positive on income, but you know, the 80s were a lousy decade for Africa, and the 90s weren't much better. So you know, that the last 10 years have been good is great, but it's not enough, and it's not as much progress as we've seen in health. We've done better at delivering on the quality of life than we have on income, but you know, that shouldn't be something that makes us depressed, right? The reason we wanted income in the first place was a better quality of life.
Now, of course, one of the really big stories, certainly in Europe and the global north, has been the economic crisis. Talks are still underway to try and save the euro, but what does the economic crisis mean for development? Charles, I'll come straight back to you. We've seen Sarah, our health editor, saying the biggest issue is money. But what impact has the economic crisis had on aid donations and things, do you think?
Oxfam came out with a study a little bit ago suggesting that we were going to see a hit, billions less. Obviously, that's not the case in the UK. I think, you know, and kudos to the government for ring-fencing aid resources. But other countries, we are seeing aid decline. I think perhaps more importantly, we're seeing knock-on effects in areas like migration flows. So actually, despite all of the heated rhetoric in the United States, if you look at the number of people actually crossing the border between Mexico and the United States as undocumented workers, it's fallen through the floor. And that's basically because there just aren't very many jobs in the United States at the moment for migrants. And that, of course, has knock-on effects because remittances, another huge story of this decade, has been the rise in remittances. Well, if people aren't moving to wealthy countries, they can't send money back to poorer countries. It's been okay that we haven't seen a huge drop-off in economic growth in the developing world. But if this financial crisis continues, and heaven forfend, that the euro collapses, I think that will have an effect on economies across the world.
Okay, now, Dina, economics has played a huge role in the Arab Spring. You're from Egypt. What impact has the crisis had on the Arab world?
Well, there are two aspects. One of them is of course the same thing, the reduction in money. And that in itself has meant, although the loans that you were getting were not necessarily, I would contest that, were not necessarily completely beneficial, and the structural adjustment programs are one example of that, but the reduction in this money in a region like that has also left the space for other kind of money, like the Gulf-funded donations or loans in that effect. And they are more, I think, lethal because they have absolutely no transparency in them, no safeguard measures, and that puts us in a very critical situation. On the other side, it's affecting a lot, I'd say, food markets, industries, mainly because of the financializations of the economy that's been happening, and with it the extreme deregulation that we've been seeing, especially in the countries that have seen the revolutions recently and who have essentially risen against that neoliberal stipulations of deregulations, extreme opening of the market, and so on.
Jayati in Delhi, can China or India take up the slack from Europe? And how is the change in global power balance towards those two countries really affecting development priorities, do you think?
Well, I mean, the first point is that no, there is no way China and India can take up the slack fully. To some small extent, yes, but quantitatively, it just doesn't add up. China and India cannot substitute for the US and Northern Europe. But I would just like to come in. I agree completely with what Dina was saying. And I would like to emphasize that, this whole notion that you need a lot of external money for governments in Africa or poor governments in Asia to be spending on health, I think that's misplaced. A lot of the money that's come in as external aid has been counterproductive because it's come with conditions that have made the broader economic situation worse. What has really caused Africa's condition to improve is the fact that the last decade has been one where its terms of trade has improved, its exports have risen dramatically, and it has many alternative sources of foreign capital, including from China and India. This has actually provided more money to African governments to spend, and a lot of that has also gone into greater infrastructure, sanitation, and health.
Jonathan, what about trade? Europe is a big trading partner for Africa. What's the collapse of consumer spending in countries like Britain or much of Europe doing for the developing world exports?
Well, certainly post-crisis, there was a dip in exports from most of the world because Europe and the United States was importing less, but the rise of China and the other big emerging powers has clearly had a big impact. And I think, you know, it's kind of consolidated the shift of power towards the emerging powers, because Africa and other countries are not doing as badly as you might have thought, largely because they have other large trading powers. I do want to say something about aid. I really strongly agree that it's not, you know, as much as important as it's cranked up to be. In Egypt, you know, billions were spent, but actually Mubarak probably took almost as much as was given to Egypt in his own personal bank account. In India, countries like India, China, Nigeria, it's well under 1% and has been for decades of the economy. It's not that important. So when we see the worries about reductions in aid, my answer would be let's start thinking about reshuffling aid rather than always talking about the need for more aid.
One thing that 2011 will be remembered for is the severe famine in Somalia and the Horn of Africa, exacerbated by the fact that al-Shabaab refused to allow access to some foreign humanitarian agencies. Tens of thousands of people fled to refugee camps in neighbouring Kenya. Let's hear some of their stories from Jamal Osman, who was there.
This is Ala Yasir camp in drought-hit southern Somalia, an area controlled by the Islamist group al-Shabaab. The camp was set up 5 months ago and is now home to 5,000 displaced people who walked days or weeks to reach here. They are waiting to collect their monthly food supplies from al-Shabaab. Fatuma Osman was one of the first to arrive.
Yes, all five of them. I brought five children into this world, and they all died.
Jayati in Delhi, do you think food security will become a major issue again next year?
It already is. In most of the developing world, this is the dominant issue on people's minds, because food prices have been rising dramatically for the last 3 years in the developing world. And the last year, things have really got very, very intense. So this is a very important issue. But while we do know about these terrible stories, for example, in Somalia, it's also important to look at the good news. For example, countries like Malawi, which moved from food deficit to food surplus, essentially by completely changing the strategy, moving away from what the IMF and the World Bank had recommended to them of abandoning their food security measures and reinstating, first of all, subsidies to farmers to make small farming viable again, and secondly, a food security umbrella in the form of food reserves. This allowed Malawi to withstand the dramatic increase in price and the major collapse that occurred in a large part of northern Africa. It was actually able to export to neighbouring countries.
Jonathan, do you think there will be continuing food crises?
I think that increased resource scarcity is going to be the story for the next 5, 10, 20 years, both with regard to the global climate. Of course, they're all linked, everything's linked, but also with regard to land, conflict over land and food. And clearly, speculation and the financialization of everything which we've heard about already has its impacts on that. And I think that's really where the international community needs to be looking at. And clearly some of the British NGOs, WDM, Christian Aid, Oxfam, are already well advanced in looking at those areas, which are much more important than the constant, you know, let's have more money for aid. I would also say, again, backing up what Jayati said, the real story of this last 5 years and the emergence of the emerging powers is that countries like Malawi are able to say to the IMF and the World Bank and the traditional donors, thanks for that policy advice, but no thanks. And that is exactly what's also happened in Latin America and all over the world. The kind of Washington consensus is dying a death. Not to say that not everything in it was wrong, but it's certainly the countries, including the poorest countries, have more policy freedom now than they have had for the last 20 or 30 years, and that has to be a good thing. Although I would also agree with Dina that in many countries the neoliberal project does continue in a slightly different name. It's still very strong.
Okay, finally to one of the more positive stories of the year. Who remembers this?
What's happened to you? Why are you worried and afraid from these gangs? What's happened to you? These gangs, like cockroaches, they don't represent anything. They're not even 1% of a million of the living people. They're nothing. They're one handful of people who are trying to imitate what's happened in Tunisia and Egypt. They were drugged. They were given orders. These are cockroaches.
Well, that's Colonel Gaddafi's tirade against the protesters in Benghazi in Libya, who went out onto the streets as part of the Arab Spring after Tunisians succeeded in overthrowing their president. Well, Gaddafi is now long gone, But will people power really bring anything to development? Can democracy cope? So Dina, the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions were very much about jobs and economic opportunities. Can you explain why the situation was so bad?
Yeah, it seems... I mean, I like to link the situation in Egypt and Tunisia to the rest of the world. I mean, you have a situation of extreme precarity, mainly, of a lot of graduates who have played by the rules of the game, if you want to call it this way, and have not found their expectations. There is a largely part of that, but also essentially also a continuation of two projects, an extreme repression that maybe is not very, is not necessarily with the same degree everywhere in the world, but there is that sense of a police state, but also something that's completely shared with the world. And then that was, again, the post-Washington consensus or the neoliberal project continuing in all sorts of different ways. I mean, one of them is essentially continuing to fund the same structures by more loans, and that's continuing even past the revolution. We're still seeing things like Cameroon and the G8 suggesting to give even more money for reconstruction and in the name of democracy. So now democracy is being the one thing that we've reshuffled to use in a continuation of an old process.
But do you think democracy really is the best way to deal with development? What about the idea of a benevolent dictator with lots of money who can push through big plans? And are you beginning to rethink the whole thing?
Well, I think we, I mean, as a world, we've passed that era of big dictators that will, big Brazil that had 10% growth and military dictatorship. I don't think we're in that stage at all, essentially because the conceptualization of development has changed. Human development as a concept, I mean, as fluffy as it looks like, but it does mean that you want political freedoms and not just economic freedoms included. So that on one side. Of course, now, what do we mean by democracy is another thing. If it's just a question of having a liberal democracy and you go vote, of course it won't change anything. And we've seen that in the most democratic countries in the world, Spain, Greece, and they have unrigged elections, and still the structures are not changing. So democracy is a real democracy, and there is a lot of forms of direct democracies that workers are applying, for example, in their industrial places, calling for a minimum wage. I see that as forms of democracy. I mean, unfortunately, they are being repressed. So we have a new law by the military that actually bans protests and fines people for protesting these kind of protests. So I think that the process is long. We're going to get with the liberal democracy a good right-wing, socially and economically Islamist force. But that's it's a long-term battle. And I think they're going to prove that they can't reduce food prices.
Jayati, in India, the world's biggest democracy, is democracy being stretched there?
I was listening to Dina with a complete appreciation, and I agree completely with what she's just said. I come from a country where we have a very, very vibrant democracy, but we haven't really delivered in terms of social and economic rights. So it's a very complex process. Of course, democracy is non-negotiable, including electoral democracy with all of its flaws and its limitations. But it's not enough. And we really need to have systems that make the process much more inclusive, not just the political process, but most of all, the economic process. I think the danger is often that there is this sheer sheen of democracy which is used, particularly by powers that would still like to be imperial, even though they have less and less opportunity for it. And this veneer of democracy is then used to push through strategies which are not really in the interests of most of the citizens.
Charles, okay, put your seer's hat on. What will 2012 bring for development, do you think, worldwide?
I think more progress, more people. I'd say one of the big bits of news this year, we went past 7 billion, and frankly, I like people, so more people is good as far as I'm concerned. We'll probably get a few more next year. I hope we will see the consolidation of the changes that are going on in the Middle East. I'd absolutely agree with Dina that democracy is part of development. So saying it's not something separate. It's just part of the process. I would say I'd hope that one of the things we see in the Middle East next year is actually, for example, in Egypt, the army getting out of running the economy to the extent it is.
And Jonathan, what will 2012 bring for development, do you think?
Well, I think from the south, from the developing countries, yeah, I see hopefully more progress, especially in Latin America. Africa is growing, but it needs to be more inclusive. There's a lot of jobless growth. hopefully China and India will continue to grow, because actually we talk about Europe not doing very well. If there's any kind of stalling in the growth over there, that could spell some seriously bad news for some of the poorer countries. Unfortunately, the other side of the equation is possibly a little bit more pessimistic. In the West, in America and Europe, the big story this year, certainly in Europe, has been very, very bad economic crisis. And in that context, it's not the fall of aid. That's a partial story. The story is more competition with countries that, at least theoretically, they were supposed to be supporting the development of. In other words, China and India are competitors. Look at what happened in the Arab Spring. The first thing we do is send in our companies to try and make money out of what's happening there.
Jati, in a sentence, what would you like to see from 2012?
What I would really love to see is a change in the economic strategy in all countries towards wage and employment-led growth, which necessarily requires that finance gets its comeuppance.
And Dina, what's your hope for 2012?
Personally, I'd like to see the military completely unsupported by anybody because of the repression it's doing on a human level and all sorts of economic and social level. So I want to see military out now.
Okay, this is John Vidal from the Guardian Development Podcast, thanking Charles Kenny, Jati Ghosh, Jonathan Glennie and Dina Makram. Thank you very much indeed for such a stimulating talk. Thank you. Good night.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.